This is Setting the Record Straight. And I'm your host, Chuck Coughlin. This is BreadboxMedia.com. Let me ask you a question. How did we lose our faith? I can tell you how I lost mine and how I regained it. It's a long story. Not worth telling right here. But in general, how did our culture lose its faith? Well, the answer to the question is that that's the wrong question. If you and I had a friend that went out drinking one Saturday night in the bars in a busy downtown, and he went out in the back alley to buy some drugs from a man he met in the bar, and the man beat him senseless and took his wallet. If we went and visited that man in the hospital the next morning, would he say to us, "I lost my wallet"? No, he would say, "My wallet was stolen. I was mugged. I was nearly assassinated." In the same sense, when we ask the question of our culture, how did we lose our faith? That's the wrong question. We were mugged. We were culturally mugged. The communication between us and God, the two-way transmissions, were jammed. We're deliberately jammed. And of course, the devil's greatest pretense is that he does not exist. And the explanation for who jammed the communication and who substituted the alternate broadcast is very clear, is enormously well documented, and I'll get to that later. But I would not be surprised to hear from you saying that you're absurd. Your explanation is absurd because we have been carefully taught that the explanation, which is extensively documented, is absurd. We've been told it's absurd. I have to repeat, you're going to think I'm crazy or paranoid. That cannot be it. It must be some other explanation. We didn't lose our faith. We were mugged. It was rather easy to do. And once we understand how we got into the problem, how we got this deep and lost in a dark cave, the way out is known. You have tremendous hope, because if you understand the path by which you got lost, then you simply retrace your steps and come back out of the cave into the light. Now, when I was a young boy, I had two volumes of fairy tales. One was by Hans Christian Andersen. Stories full of delight, fantasy, emotion, tears, the Christmas tree, stories like that. And The Little Mermaid, the real story of The Little Mermaid, the very religious story of The Little Mermaid, all about her soul, unlike the Disney film, which is a betrayal of the real meaning of the story. Read the original. It's on the internet. But back to my theme. The other book was by the Brothers Grimm. These are Grimm tales indeed. Now, I didn't exactly enjoy those, but I was fascinated and transfixed by them, because they're full of devils in disguise appearing to try to mislead little children. And one of the stories, which greatly illustrates what happened to us, how do we end up in the spiritual hospital? The story is the Pied Piper of Hamelin. It's very short. Here's how it goes. Children of Hamelin by Jacob and Wilhelm Grimm. In the year 1284, a mysterious man appeared in Hamelin. He was wearing a coat of many-colored bright cloth, for which reason he was called the Pied Piper. He claimed to be a rat-catcher, and he promised that for a certain sum that he would rid the city of all mice and rats. The citizens struck a deal, promising him a certain price. The rat-catcher then took a small fife from his pocket and began to blow on it. Rats and mice immediately came from every house and gathered around him. When he thought that he had them all, he led them into the river Weser, where he pulled up his clothes and walked into the water. The animals all followed him, fell in, and drowned. Now that the citizens had been freed of their plague, they regretted having promised so much money, and using all kinds of excuses, they refused to pay him. Finally, he went away, bitter and angry. He returned on St. John's and St. Paul's Day, June 26, early in the morning. Others say it was at noon. Now dressed in a hunter's costume, with a dreadful look on his face and wearing a strange red hat, he sounded his fife in the streets. But this time it wasn't rats and mice that came to him, but rather children. A great number of boys and girls, from their fourth year on. Among them was the mayor's grown daughter. The swarm followed him, and he led them into a mountain, where he disappeared with them. All this was seen by a babysitter, who, carrying a child in her arms, had followed them from a distance, but had then turned around and carried the news back to town. The anxious parents ran in droves to the town gates, seeking their children. The mothers cried out and sobbed pitifully. Within the hour, messengers were sent everywhere by water and by land, inquiring if the children, or any of them, had been seen. But it was all for naught. In total, 130 were lost. Two, as some say, had lagged behind and came back. One of them was blind, and the other mute. The blind one was not able to point out the place, but was able to tell how they had followed the piper. The mute one was able to point out the place, although he or she had heard nothing. One little boy in shirt sleeves had gone along with the others, but had turned back to fetch his jacket, and thus escaped the tragedy, for when he returned, the others had already disappeared into a cave within a hill. The cave is still shown. Until the middle of the 18th century, and probably still today, the street through which the children was led out to the town gate was called Bungalosa, drumless, soundless, quiet. No dancing or music was allowed there. Indeed, when a bridal procession on its way to church crossed the street, the musicians would have to stop playing. The mountain near Hamelin, where the children disappeared, is called Poppenberg. Two stone monuments in the form of crosses have been erected there, one on the left side and one on the right. Some say the children were led into a cave, and they came out again in Transylvania. The citizens of Hamelin recorded this event in their town register, and they came to date all their proclamations according to the years and days since the loss of their children. According to Siegfried, the 22nd rather than the 26th of June was entered into the town register. The following lines were inscribed on the town hall. In the year 1284, after the birth of Christ, from Hamelin were led away 130 children, born at this place, led away by a piper into a mountain. And on the new gate was inscribed, "This gate was built 272 years after the magician led the 130 children from the city." In the year 1572, the mayor had the story portrayed in the church windows. The accompanying inscription has become largely illegible. In addition, a coin was minted in memory of the event. So this is told by Jacob and Wilhelm Grimm in the form of a documentary story about this legend. The children of Hamelin, the Kinder zu Hamelin. Now, it's not called, of course, the Pied Piper of Hamelin, as it's represented in some other versions. There's a lot of versions of this story. That great genius of German literature, Wolfgang von Goethe, wrote this story in a beautiful form himself. And his version was set to music by a great German songwriter, Hugo Wolf. Strange little song. I'll close some of the sections with a bit of that song. Coming back to my point, what has happened is the children were seduced and taken away and disappeared. The Pied Piper did not attempt to change everyone. He knew that it was sufficient to change the children and capture their minds, isolate them from their parents, and given a little time, he would win his Kulturkampf. He would win his culture war. This legend is a parable for our own times. Today we'll be considering the stream of history they were writing. What is it that jammed our communication with God, that stole his voice from us? Did this happen? This is a stream. The stream of history contains the birth and death of many cultures. It has been said our culture has been dying. It certainly seems apparent. In this program, I'm going to talk about some of the streams that have changed history. I'm going to be talking about the great windstorm that is changing our history within my lifetime. I've seen us cross a huge continental divide in our culture, in the way we thought, in the way we did everything, around 1960, around the middle of the 20th century. I got to know my grandparents quite well, and to witness and to sense their life and their lifestyles and their culture and their thoughts. It was a culture and a lifestyle and a belief that had not changed for centuries in any essential way. What I saw was a life that, in many respects, technology aside, had a sense of foundational permanence. The culture that held society together, and the cult at the center of that culture, cult in the best meaning of the term, had not changed. Then what we call the sexual revolution of the 60s occurred. Why did this occur? Are you satisfied that we really know all of the main sources of that revolution? The primary impetus, the primary source, is rather well known. But despite it being factual, few want to accept it. It certainly is very extensively documented. But because the devil's greatest trick is to sell a conviction that he does not exist, it appears to me that very few people I know seem to understand what has happened, or therefore what steps we should take to recover our culture, to heal ourselves. The more I've learned about this, the more I have a great hope that we can do exactly that. We know how it was done. It's a long, arduous path, but it's a simple path. We know what to do to revive Christendom. Even better, I have great confidence and optimism that we can revive Catholicdom. Let's take a break now. We'll go out with a little bit of the rather creepy Pied Piper song.
Ich bin der wohlbekannte Sänger, der vielgereiste Rattenfänger, der diese altberühmte Stadt gewiss besonders nötig hat. Und wären's Ratten noch so viele und wäre Wiesel mit im Spiele, von allen soll er mich diesen Ort, sie müssen miteinander fort.
Breadbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit breadboxmedia.com.
Good to have you back after the break. Just before the break, I read one version of the Pied Piper of Hamelin, called The Children of Hamelin, in which an itinerant musician led away the children, 130 children from the village of Hamelin that disappeared. Now, you may have caught my implication in using the Pied Piper as a parable for our own situation. And if you did, you probably want to ask me, well, who's the Pied Piper in our situation? Well, it's not one, it's a group, and we know exactly who they are. Been very well documented. Yale University has issued a 20-volume series documenting the background of this. Our Pied Pipers entranced our youth and led them away from their parents, out of the sound of their voices. It's a culture war. It's the culture comp all over again. A very important part of the strategy is to make sure it's done like it was done in the legend of the Pied Piper. Do it early in the morning when everybody's asleep, when the parents are asleep. Do it quietly. Don't be noticed. Slowly. Surely. Early in the morning. Don't make any loud noises. Don't alert them. Don't warn them. Entrance the children. It happened to our children. It's what they did in Poland. It's what they did in Hungary. It's what the Masonic Marxist government did to the Cristeros in Mexico. It's what Bismarck did in Germany. It's what John Dewey did in the United States to our public schools. You take over the schools first, but you go through all the institutions, higher academia, the media, the arts, the movies, the music, especially the music. And you create a separation between the youth and the adults. The most important tactic in this is to create a youth culture separate from the adult. So many people think it's a normal thing to have a youth culture that is different from the adult culture. And maybe a preteen culture separate from the teenage culture. The concept of the teenager and all its characteristics is a modern invention and a destructive one. Just as a separate youth culture is a destructive phenomenon and a freakish phenomenon. Unusual in history. Very unusual. Better than that, you create a repulsion of the youth for the adults. Was done here very deliberately. It was carefully planned. It was done with sophisticated artistry. It happened. It wasn't an accident. We did not stumble. We were pushed. And if you're an expert cultural warrior, and you wait a few decades, Your agents will move into senior positions. But your agents are not the ones that do the work. They're not the face of it. No, what you've done is select who are entirely unaware that they're subversive. For a good culture war, you need to select the egotists, because they think they're a breath of fresh air. The more they believe they're saving the abused children from their parents' culture, the better their effect will be. Stalin had a word for these people. Useful idiots. He was using them. And from where do you recruit them? My friend, they are legion. You simply select the useful idiots, put those in place, put them in the driver's seat. They'll topple the culture. And without firing a single shot, you've won a war. You've toppled and conquered a nation, and you can do what with it you will. You've taught an entire culture to fall out of love with themselves, out of love with their nation, out of love with their culture, and out of love with their God. And you've supplanted it with a Pied Piper song. So if somebody asks you, what happened? You can tell them, well, here's who did it, and here's what they did. Very well known, but very seldom acknowledged. That's part of it. The less you acknowledge it, the less chance you will have to reverse it. Let's identify it and talk about how to reverse it. But we need to add a bit of background in here. Let's talk about a bit of recent history, and maybe it will become clear to you just who our Pied Piper is. The end of Christianity, and especially Catholicism, has long been sought by a man most famous and infamous. Karl Marx called religion the opiate of the masses. I have to say that I rather impishly enjoy outraging opponents of the Catholic Church by saying, the sad thing is, as it has turned out, is that atheism is now the opiate of the masses. Many people, when they're young, might become confused about this issue. I'll give you an example of a very famous person. Winston Churchill, after reading an anti-Catholic tract, Martyrdom of Man, when he was only 21 years old and somewhat sophomoric, wrote to his mother, "Dear Mother, one of these days the cold, bright light of science and reason will shine through the cathedral windows, and we shall go out into the fields and seek God for ourselves. The great laws of nature will be understood. Our destiny, our past will be clear. We shall then be able to dispense with the religious toys that have agreeably fostered the development of mankind." Less respectful of these, quote, religious toys was Friedrich Nietzsche. "I regard Christianity as the most fatal, seductive lie that ever existed." His admirer, Adolf Hitler, agreed, "The heaviest blow that ever struck humanity was the coming of Christianity." Actually, Hitler thought it would have been better for the world if the Muslims had won the 8th century Battle of Tours, which stopped the Arab advance into France. Hitler reasoned that had the Christians lost, the Germanic peoples would have acquired a more warlike creed, and because of their natural superiority, would have become the leaders of an Islamic empire. His chief architect, Albert Speer, wrote that Hitler would often say, "You see, it's been our misfortune to have the wrong religion. Why didn't we have the religion of the Japanese, who regard sacrifice for the fatherland as the highest good? The Mohammed religion would have been much more compatible to us than Christianity. Why did it have to be Christianity with its meekness and flabbiness?" Isn't it interesting that even those that hate Christianity will admit that mankind cannot do without religion? Hitler did concede in Mein Kampf that what writer-historian Hilaire Belloc and Christopher Dawson would contend, religion is indispensable to society. Hitler wrote, "This human world of ours would be inconceivable without the practical existence of religious belief. The great masses of a nation are not composed of philosophers. For the masses of the people, especially faith, is absolutely the only basis of a moral outlook on life. The various substitutes that have been offered have not shown any results that might warrant us in thinking that they might usefully replace the existing dominations." As for his Nazi elite with his Darwinian pagan ideology, Hitler added, "There may be a few hundreds of thousands of superior men who can live wisely and intelligently without depending on the general standards which prevail in everyday life. But the millions of others cannot do so." Stalin, who had sought to eradicate Christianity, recognized its hold on the Russian people. In the Great Patriotic War, he opened cathedrals and churches, released bishops and clergy from prison, and called on her sons to fight not for party or Politburo, but for Mother Russia. Stalin understood that the Russian masses were not Marxists, but God and country Christians. But by 1938, he concluded that Europe was losing its faith to skepticism, agnosticism, and atheism. And Belloc wrote that the West had embarked on a voyage certain to end on the reef of civilizational ruin. Belloc went on, "A skeptical attitude toward transcendental things cannot for masses of men endure. It has been the despair of many that this should be so. They deplore the despicable weakness of mankind, which compels the acceptance of some philosophy or some religion in order to carry on at all. But we have here a matter of a positive and universal experience. Human society cannot carry on without some creed, because a code and a character are the product of a creed." In this, Belloc echoed the belief of Washington, John Adams, and others that religion and morality were interdependent and indispensable to the survival of a free society and a virtuous republic. I get the feeling in our meditation that we need to get specific here, maybe give some statistics. We know that our society is in trouble, but the trouble is a lot worse than a lot of people realize. There's a veritable mountain of empirical data to look at that shows this. So let's look at a little handful of it, a little clod of this mountain. I'll tell you up front, the data shows we're witnessing a social decomposition. This is an ominous thought, isn't it? Dostoevsky's fictional character, Ivan Karamazov, said God is dead. Well, if God is dead, is not everything permitted? So it seems today. What are the social consequences of the end of Christian America? Let's do a little bit of statistical assessing. Since 1960, the U.S. illegitimacy rate had rocketed from 5% of all births to 41%. Among African Americans, the share of births out of wedlock is 71%, up from 23% in 1960. In other words, a threefold increase. The percentage of households that were married couple families with children under 18 had plummeted to 2006, had plummeted by 2006 to just 21.6%, about one out of five. Since Roe v. Wade, far more than 50 million abortions have been performed. In 1990, the teenage suicide rate tripled. Though the number fell then, as of 2006, suicide was the third leading cause of death of young adults and adolescents aged 15 to 24, just behind homicides. Cheating in scholastics and sports and marriage is pandemic. Between 60 and 1992, violent crime, murder, rape, assault, soared 550%. The subsequent decline is due to the passing of the baby boomers out of the high crime ages, 16 to 36, and a 700% increase in the prison population, which is about 2.5 million Americans, with 5 million more on probation and parole. Gracious, a break approaches, and I need a little comforting music. Sit back in your chair. From the music of Hector Berlioz, The Infancy of Christ, listen to Mary pray over the Christ child, singing, "Oh, mon cher, oh, my darling."
Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
On Redbox Media, this is Chuck Coughlin back after the break. Setting the record straight. Talking a bit ruefully today about the entrancing of our youth by a set of Pied Pipers. I was starting to give specifics. There's some more. They're depressing statistics, and you may know some of them already. I'm sure you do. But basically, they show that Our American culture is disassembling, is dying. As the family falls apart, the family is the basic building block of society. So how can the whole structure stand? Perhaps some attribute it to individualistic hedonism, the Playboy philosophy, MTV morality, all things dominant in Hollywood and society. Rather than ushering in a new utopia, this new freedom, this abandonment of traditional morality, has unleashed a sea of misery. Our culture has become coarse and cheapening the value and dignity of the human life. So today's social decomposition, which is documented every day by those who keep up with the press, of the collapse of Christianity and the moral order it sustained. This is the triumph of a man named Antonio Gramsci. He is the first of the Pied Pipers we're going to examine, and the cultural revolution of the 1960s, where the violent victories of Lenin and Mao Zedong were eventually reversed. Antonio Gramsci, an Italian communist theoretician who died in the 1930s after years in a fascist prison, proved to be the more perceptive Marxist. Gramsci saw that while the Bolsheviks had seized total power, they had not won over the people. The people obeyed but hated their rulers and loathed the system. Their love and loyalty went not to the party or the state, but to three things: to family, faith, and Mother Russia. So Antonio Gramsci concluded that Christianity had immunized the West against communism. The Russian people had lived for 1,000 years with the Christian faith and cultural traditions. It caused them to recoil from Marxism as immoral and unpatriotic, and to reject the new communist order as illegitimate, godless, and evil. So Gramsci concluded, until Christianity was seared out of the soul of Western man, communism could never take root. Therefore, Marxists must conduct a, quote, long march through the institutions, unquote. And I want to note here that Gramsci was not alone. He was a member of a group called the Frankfurt School. And we could talk about all of those if we had more time. Well, we'll take him as an iconic representation of that group. The Frankfurt School was a group of intellectuals who later migrated to the United States. These were smart people. They understood that they had to destroy the Catholic Church in order to destroy the family, in order to create the utopia, the Marxist utopia. So Antonio Gramsci understood and concluded that they had to conduct, that the Marxists had to conduct a long march through the institutions, religious, cultural, and educational of the West. They had to uproot Christianity and its teaching about God, man, and morality, create a new people who would not reflexively reject Marxism. Gramsci was a diagnostician of society, and the cultural Marxism he preached triumphed in the West, while the revolutions of Lenin and Stalin ultimately failed in the East. For 2 millennia, Christianity provided the immune system of Western man. When an immune system breaks down, opportunistic infections enter and mugs and kills the host organism. Today, when you segment adults into groups, young adults are the least religious in the United States. Only about 20% of the group called young adults attend religious services at least once a week. And these young people are almost deaf to the call of community and common decency. Any notion of the responsibilities of a common humanity, a transcendent call to protect the life and dignity of one's neighbor, or a moral responsibility to seek the common good, was almost entirely absent among the respondents. This is from an article by a sociologist, Christian Smith, who sifted through data from the National Study of Youth and Religion. Smith wrote an article describing a generation of moral barbarians, trousered apes, in the depiction of C.S. Lewis. A second consequence of the death of faith is the loss of social unity and an unraveling of a community that had been bonded together, and segmenting of society into groups, most dangerously into groups by age. We entered the age of ages. This resulted in a series of culture wars, a culture wars within a nation, within a society, cultural war after cultural war, without end. Christopher Dawson warned that should the West lose its Christian faith, its culture would fragment and its civilization would disintegrate. Dawson wrote, "It is the religious impulse which supplies the cohesive force, which unifies a culture and civilization. The great civilizations of the world do not produce the great religions as a kind of cultural byproduct. The great religions themselves are the foundations on which the great civilizations rest. A society that has lost its religion becomes sooner or later a society that has lost its culture. All the more so if a society is assaulted, mugged, and robbed of its religion, as we have been. So since we now have no common moral ground on which to stand, the matters on which we clash multiply. Now we fight not only over politics and economics, but over abortion, embryonic stem research, homosexuality, assisted suicide, public displays of religious symbols, evolution, and what our children should be taught and should not be taught about morality and God in public schools, in the common schools. Public schools had to be drained of academic freedom. How can you teach history without teaching about religion, which is history's central trunk? And if we no longer agree on what is right and wrong, we could never be one people again. 8 years after Charles Darwin's Origin of the Species appeared, the poet Matthew Arnold, in his very famous poem, Dover Beach, saw the faith that had created Europe inexorably receding. It's such a beautiful poem. I'm never tired of hearing it or reading it. Dover Beach. The sea is calm tonight. The tide is full. The moon lies fair upon the straits. On the French coast, the light gleams and is gone. The cliffs of England stand, glimmering and vast out in the tranquil bay. Come to the window. Sweet is the night air. Only from the long line of spray, where the sea meets the moon blanched land. Listen, you hear the grating roar of pebbles which the waves draw back and fling? At their return up the high strand, begin and cease and then again begin, with tremulous cadence slow and bring the eternal note of sadness in. Sophocles, long ago, heard it on the Aegean, and it brought into his mind the turbid ebb and flow of human misery. We find also in the sound a thought, hearing it by this distant northern sea. The sea of faith was once too at the full, and round the earth's shore lay like the folds of a bright girdle furled. But now I only hear its melancholy long withdrawing roar, retreating to the breath of the night wind down the vast edges drear and naked shingles of the world. Ah, love, let us be true to one another. For the world, which seems to lie before us like a land of dreams, so various, so beautiful, so new, hath really neither joy, nor love, nor light, nor certitude, nor peace, nor help for pain. And we are here as on a darkling plain, swept with confused alarms of struggle and flight, where ignorant armies clash by night. If you expect me to have something to say after that, I don't know. It leaves me breathless, the beauty of that poem. And the human stain of melancholy longing in it, tilting on the edge of despair. What's very important about it is what it reveals about what we're up against. What it says about what must be the design of our new evangelization. We spend a lot of time talking about the new evangelization. We have many quite various descriptions of what the new evangelization is and what it should be. But sometimes they can seem a bit incomplete when you realize the magnitude of the target. Sometimes they appear to be rather thin soup, going with a slingshot against a cannon. Christendom and Catholic doom has been untaught by disinformation, untaught, have been carefully, artfully, cleverly, massively untaught. We live in an age of superstition, knotted, complex superstitions, and we are here as on a darkling plain swept with confused alarms, a struggle in flight, where ignorant armies clash by night.
Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
I've come back to you after the break. I'm Chuck Coughlin, and this is redboxmedia.com, and I'm setting the record straight. The title of this program is Our Culture Commits Suicide. Yet lives. There's a way to come back. And telling you to don't give up hope, there's a way to come back. In the last segment, we listened to and talked about Dover Beach by Matthew Arnold in a setting by Samuel Barber. And its rather poignant view of our situation, where the tide of faith had receded. Before we leave this kind of vision of truth-telling about what we're up against, expressed through wonderful language. Thinking about Dover Beach, I think about another poem. Another poem comes immediately to mind. So before I conclude this, I want to talk about that poem too. Another far greater poet, Irish poet William Butler Yeats, saw Christianity as a magnetic force that held our world together. In 1920, he sensed the West had gone deaf to the call of its God. He wrote about these feelings in a poem called The Second Coming. My opinion, one of the great poems of the 20th century. Did I say he wrote about feelings? Yes, he did, but much more than that. A prophetic, perceptive, penetrating vision. It's short, I want to read it all. The Second Coming. Turning and turning in the widening gyre. The falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart. The center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. The blood-dimmed tide is loosed, and everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all convictions, while the worst are full of a passionate intensity. Surely some revelation is at hand. Surely the second coming is at hand. The second coming. Hardly are those words out when a fast image out of Spiritus Mundi troubles my sight. A waste of desert sand, a shape with a lion's body and a head of a man, a gaze blank and pitiless as the sun, is moving its slow thighs, while all about it wind shadows of the indignant desert birds. The darkness drops again. But now I know the 20 centuries of stony sleep were vexed to nightmare by a rocking cradle. And what rough beast, its hour come round at last, slouches toward Bethlehem to be born. It seems to me that these words certainly invoke something of the sense of our enemy. In the new evangelization, we need to know our enemy. We need to understand his power and his techniques. Our problem has been how powerfully well he has used disinformation against us, against Pope Pius XII, against Cardinal Mazzetti, and in many other ways throughout the 20th century. What we have to recognize is how they did it, by taking over the means of communication, the media and academia, and altering the way we think and what we think about. We can do that too. We have an advantage over them, the great advantage, that we can use the truth and use the arts and the media to win back the culture. We must not underestimate our enemy, his size and his power. You might get the feeling that we're David looking at Goliath. Well, it's not true. We have every reason to have hope, and much better than hope, to have courage, to have courage. In this culture war, we have the best weapons. One of our best weapons is beauty, true, radiant, virtuous beauty. And our great advantage in the debate is we can use the truth. Our opponents have been winning battle after battle by using disinformation, artful and clever lies that appear to be true. We have truth on our side and beauty on our side. It's through the media that we will win. This is a culture war. The political war is important. The military war is important. All these other issues, disease, immigration, technology, science, are all important. But the most important thing is concepts. And what we have on our side as Catholics is the beautiful images of Catholic art in every form of art, in every form of culture. The huge potential, largely untapped, I'm sad to say, of truly reverent and truly magnificent Catholic music. Most important Catholic drama, TV, and movies, infused and animated by spirit. We just have to do more of it, and it has to be the center of culture. We can win it if we just believe in the beauty of the Catholic Church, of Christ's creation, the Catholic Church. But how do we gain control of the centers of the media, the power centers, the same way they did? They bought it. 1 out of 4 Americans are Catholic. If we stuck together, we could buy the media and replace our adversaries with our proponents, with ourselves, with truth tellers, with people who love our culture, love our country, love us, and love our God. How did we get to where we are? Because a concerted force can have great effect in a free society if it concentrates its well-planned efforts. You can determine the content of the media and of the arts. You can shape the way people feel by creating the music that tells them how to feel, tells them how to love. That's what happened. That's how our souls were depraved. We were subverted from outside. The Soviet Union, recognizing that once both sides had the bomb, that we had mutually assured destruction. So they reevaluated the methods they'd been using. So street riots, military weapons, while not entirely abandoned, didn't become their main interest. What they did at that point is to concentrate on propaganda, on disinformation, on causing us to fall out of love with ourselves, to teaching us lessons about ourselves that were not so, by telling us that we were less virtuous than we really were. They used the arts to make our virtues appear ridiculous. This had an effect on everything, because everything is downstream of culture. People learn to feel and to think from culture, from the media, from the arts. Most profoundly, powerfully, from music. And look what happened to the music. Look what happened to our music. A separate youth culture of revolutionary, transgressive music was created to become the ideal of our youth. And we were told not to interfere with it. It was done from central notes of power. If we Catholics would only stick together, we could buy those notes of power and change everything back. Now, the Soviet Union went out of existence. But like a snake that has been killed, that was a poisonous snake, though you killed it, it had already bitten you. Its venom was in your blood. This anti-Catholic and anti-Christ venom is in the blood of our culture. But we have the anti-venom. It's truth in the hands of a Catholic media, Catholic artists, Catholic writers. And the courage to change it back by the same way it was done, by investing in the culture, taking it over, and telling the truth with great beauty. They bought the sources of power in our culture and changed everything. Our schools, our academia, and placed useful idiots, carefully selected actors who didn't know the real objectives, but were high priests and priestesses of the new religion of the sexual revolution, of an atheistic materialism. That then, of course, became an epidemic in our world. They did it with a carefully planned program out of the KGB in Moscow, out of the Stasi in Romania. The 20-volume series that Yale University published that gives foundational data on this that I referred to is about the Soviet archives, the KGB archives. They were open for scholars to look at for about 4 years. And we found evidence of the subversion of our Catholic Church and of our nation. We found that they actually had placed their agents within the church, within the clergy, in the posts of important political leaders of our nation. We only saw a tiny fragment of it, but enough to know that we had not been sufficiently on the guard. What they knew about, and we don't seem to understand, is the power of the media, the power of the arts, is immense. That's what the Vatican is about. That's what the Pietà and the Sistine Chapel are about. That art is an enormously powerful evangelical force. We are a free society. To put it in a sort of crude way, we need to buy the media and fire them. And then by hiring the right people of artistic genius, that we can present the truth and we can win back everyone, starting with the youth, and teach them to respect and treasure the wisdom of their elders. And this is most important, to have the same culture, to have the same music. When I was 16, my 92-year-old grandfather and I had the same number one song. Listen to the same number one song on the hit parade. While we were unaware, the people in our families who were of different ages were made to have separate cultures. They were separated. The change that occurred was a distortion. All this didn't happen by accident. And the way back will not happen by accident. We have to create it. You know, I love breadboxmedia.com. It's part of the hope. It's one part of this recreation. You have to help us. Go to our website. You're on our website, breadboxmedia.com. Click on Bless the Yes and look at the amazing opportunity there. You can be part of the way back. But maybe there's other ways you can help us. Write us. Tell us your thoughts. You know, I see the way back out of this. And the media, in this case, breadboxmedia.com, is part of, is an example of the solution of what we have to do. We have to make movies. We have to make TV shows. We have to make music. We have to make podcasts. We have to show the truth about things like the Crusades. If all this sounds like too grand an idea, then I want to point out that our problem is rather immense. If it sounds like pie in the sky, it's been proved not to be. It can be done. They did it, we can do it. And I really don't think anything else is going to work. This is Chuck Coughlin for Setting the Record Straight. Let's do it.